From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the primaries and political punditry with Michael Kinsley. He was Patrick Buchanan's longtime sparring partner on the CNN program Crossfire. Kinsley is also former editor of The New Republic. He recently left the Beltway to edit an online news magazine, which is scheduled to begin publication in late May. Also, it's been said that novelist Stephen McCauley puts the fun into dysfunction. The author of The Object of My Affection has a new novel. We'll talk with McCauley about The Man of the House. And some thoughts on the future of Apple Computer from our commentator Stephen Levy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Two Republican presidential candidates have dropped out of the race, while two others have picked up strong endorsements. Indiana Senator Richard Lugar left the race today, saying his White House bid was exciting, but that reality had set in.
I know now that I will not be the Republican Party nominee for president in 1996. After a remarkable day of voting in 10 states yesterday, the apparent nominee is a man for whom I have great admiration, Senator Bob Dole of Kansas, and I look forward to his presidency.
Former Tennessee Governor Lamar Alexander has also bowed out of the Republican presidential contest. He, too, decided to back Dole, saying that the senator is the man that most Republican voters want to see as the Republican presidential nominee. Dole picked up a third significant endorsement from Texas Governor George W. Bush. Bush says Dole is the man who can use the presidency to change America for the better.
America needs your strength to stand up for our families and our values. America needs your strength as the commander-in-chief of our country. To change America, we must change presidents. Senator Dole, we need your integrity and character in our White House, and I am proud to be able to do anything I can to help you achieve the presidency of the United States.
And publisher Steve Forbes has received the backing of former New York Congressman Jack Kemp. Kemp says he made the difficult decision to support Forbes after hearing New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato and Mr. Dole denounce the flat tax, a main proposal of Forbes. Kemp backs the flat tax. A federal judge has ordered defense attorney F. Lee Bailey to turn over $2 million by this afternoon, otherwise he's going to jail for contempt of court. From member station WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida, Jim Christie reports.
A federal judge in Florida last month found Bailey in civil contempt for not producing money and stock entrusted to him by a former client as part of a drug case. When Bailey did not satisfy the demands, the judge ordered him to turn over $3 million in cash and the stock or report to jail. Bailey's attorney had argued that his client satisfied part of the court order to produce the money, including handing over more than $700,000 in cash. But Tuesday, a federal appeals panel in Atlanta upheld the Florida judge's decision. Bailey must turn over $2.3 million by 5 p.m. Eastern or surrender to federal authorities to begin serving a six-month prison term. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Christie in Tallahassee, Florida.
A federal appeals court has struck down Washington State's ban on doctor-assisted suicide. The decision was 8-3. The judges say the law against the practice is unconstitutional because it violates the rights of terminally ill, mentally competent adults. On Wall Street, the Dow is up. This is NPR. Authorities in Alabama say that six people are dead from a violent storm that raked across the state. The deaths were in trailer parks and in mobile homes in two different Alabama counties. Meanwhile, dozens of people have been hurt as the severe weather system rolls across Arkansas, Mississippi, and Georgia. A spokesman for the National Weather Service says the bad weather was caused by a cold front colliding with warmer, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico. The spokesman says the weather problems are not over. Three U.S. servicemen will be sentenced in Okinawa tomorrow for their roles in the kidnapping and rape of a Japanese schoolgirl last year. A lawyer for one of the men says the 10-year sentence that prosecutors want is too harsh. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Okinawa.
The six-month-long ordeal of the rape case that pushed Okinawa and its U.S. presence into the international spotlight is about to close. In Japan, criminal cases virtually always end in conviction, and the only mystery is typically how long defendants will be punished. Legal experts expect guilty verdicts for each serviceman on the counts of rape and abduction, and sentences of anywhere from 2 to 10 years. In denouncing the prosecution's recommendation of 10 years, defense attorneys said public reaction is playing too great a role in the case, which has ignited a hostility toward the U.S. military that has not been seen here in decades. Tokyo and Washington are both closely watching the outcome in preparation for a reaffirmation of the U.S.-Japan Security Alliance when President Clinton arrives next month. In Okinawa, this is Julie McCarthy.
The government says Americans' productivity rose 1.1% last year. Productivity is the key measurement of how fast living standards can rise. The gain was the best showing in 3 years, but it's far below the kind of increase recorded in the decades after World War II. Again on Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 11 points at 56.53. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bob Dole won all 8 of yesterday's Republican primaries. Today, 2 of his rivals, Lamar Alexander and Richard Lugar, dropped out. Even Patrick Buchanan admitted that Dole's nomination seems inevitable, although Buchanan is staying in the race. My guest Michael Kinsley is, among other things, Patrick Buchanan's former sparring partner on the CNN show Crossfire. They were co-hosts for the better part of 6 years. Kinsley is also the former editor of The New Republic. He writes essays for Time magazine and has been published in The New Yorker. Many of his essays from the past 9 years are published in his new book, Big Babies. Kinsley recently left the Beltway for the state of Washington, where he's launching a new online news magazine that will be published by Microsoft. I asked him, now that Dole is the likely Republican nominee, how much power he thinks Buchanan will have to shape the Republican agenda.
I think he'll have less power than people now think. You know, it was in the interest of the media to keep this thing a horse race as long as they possibly could. And that was why Buchanan, one reason at least, why Buchanan got such a ride. And even Lamar Alexander, who never got many votes, was treated very seriously for a long time. The Republicans are now all going to rally around, and I think Pat will himself pipe down a little bit. I could be wrong. So I think he will not have all that much influence, because Dole's going to win it overwhelmingly. He's not going to really need Buchanan. There'll be a little bit of a tussle about how big a role he'll have at the convention. Will he get to give a speech? Will it be live? Will it be prime time and all that sort of thing? And people will say, look what happened when he gave that speech in 1992. And we'll rehash all that stuff. But I don't think he'll have much influence.
What does the primary say to you about the state of the Republican Party?
Well, I am not one of these people who believes that the Republicans are going to tear themselves apart, and I think I've been borne out on this. I'm a Democrat. I'm usually vote Democratic. I'm sympathetic to the Democratic Party, but Democrats are enthusiastic committers of fratricide. They love having internal wars tearing themselves apart. I like to say liberals are always looking for heretics. Conservatives are always looking for converts. And the Republicans are much more businesslike. I admire their efficiency, their ruthlessness. There is no way they were going to let Pat Buchanan tear this party apart, and they didn't.
Do you think that the results of yesterday's primaries are going to turn Super Tuesday into No Big Deal Tuesday?
Yeah, I do think that. I think, in fact, this whole Republican experience may have the salutary result of not only reducing the influence of Super Tuesday, but reducing the influence of New Hampshire. Because I think for the first time since 1964, this could be wrong, the nominee of the Republican Party will not be the guy who won New Hampshire. And I think that would be a healthy thing. Let some other state have its turn.
Does it annoy you that New Hampshire has this big symbolic importance in the primaries?
Well, I've listened now for 4 years to John Sununu telling me how this New Hampshire is the perfect place for this sort of thing to go on. But he failed to persuade me. It does seem to me a little silly that, for example, Pat Buchanan can win by a few hundred votes in one party's primary in a small state like New Hampshire, and suddenly for a month be taken seriously as a presidential candidate. It does seem to me to be sort of an unrealistic system we have there.
Your new book, your new collection is called Big Babies. And in the introduction, you talk about how if there's a theme that runs through these pieces, it's your annoyance at the fatuous populism that dominates American politics. I want you to describe what you mean by that fatuous populism and if you see that playing out in the presidential race.
I guess a brief summary of this fatuous populism, pseudo-populism I would call it, is the politicians are awful, but the people are wonderful. And the problem with this country is that the politicians are alienated from the people and separate from the people and don't give the people what they want. In fact, the political problems we face, the federal debt being the clearest example, are a result of the politicians being exquisitely attuned to the wishes of the people and giving the people exactly what they want. And I'm not here to say that the politicians are so wonderful, but the people aren't so great either. and blaming our problems on the politicians ignoring the wishes of the people gets it exactly wrong. That's the basic point of the Big Baby's theme running through this book.
Well, you also say that people demand flagrantly incompatible things, such
yes,
as...
Yes, they say, how dare you raise up my taxes, how dare you cut my middle-class entitlement programs, and dear, oh dear, how dare you run up this national debt.
They
don't, as I say in this book, they don't want leadership, they want alchemy.
So how do you see this playing out in the presidential race?
Well, it's played out in an interesting way. Over recent years, the main victims of this populist resentment have been the Democrats, because the Republicans have come in and say the Democrats are running up this national debt, the Democrats are mismanaging the government, and there are these easy solutions. And then now the Republicans are controlling Congress, suddenly they're the victims of it, and I almost have to feel a little sorry for them. The people are saying, yes, we want a balanced budget, but we don't want our Medicare touched. And the Democrats have done a little bit of demagoguing on that, as the Republicans did in earlier years. But the Republicans are on the losing side of it. So it's, you could say it's fitting revenge, or you could say it's an unfortunate sign for our country, and I guess it's a little bit of both.
Michael Kinsley is my guest, and his new collection of pieces is called Big Babies. He's the former editor of The New Republic, the former TRB columnist, a former co-host of Crossfire on CNN, and he's now getting ready to launch a new online news magazine. Well, as Patrick Buchanan's former co-host on CNN's Crossfire, do you look at Buchanan and think, my gosh, it might have been me running for president?
No, I have never had the slightest interest in political office. Or it seems to me running for office is so awful. Pat really enjoys being on the hustings. People ask me, why is he doing it? And I ask myself, why on earth is he doing it, since he never has a chance? And one answer to that is he had a bit more of a chance than I gave him credit for, although that was already, we can see now, today, as opposed to a week ago or 2 weeks ago, vastly exaggerated. But the other answer is he really loves being out there on the speaking circuit. He loves the adulation, the crowds. He loves talking, hearing his own voice. And I think a lot of people with political ambition, you have to have a certain love of that. Bill Clinton has a love of being on the campaign trail. Even Bob Dole does. But it seems like an awful life to me, and I think to most sensible people.
It must be really interesting for you to watch him on the campaign trail, since you know him so well.
Well, you know, Terry, I don't really know him well. We worked together for the best part of 6 years. Every afternoon we had this very intense on-the-air experience of arguing with each other. And he was always very affable and friendly most of the time. Sometimes we got into fights that lasted after the cameras went off. But most of the time, you know, he was civil and even friendly. But I don't ever feel I was ever his friend or we ever connected in any social way. Or that, for that matter, that I ever really understood him as a person. There's a certain opaqueness there.
Michael, how did you get involved in the TV pundit business?
Well, I was editor of The New Republic for many years in Washington. The New Republic is a very useful institution for the TV producers and TV bookers needing people to come on and argue things, because it's people who are well, it's staff or people who are well informed about what's going on in Washington who are allowed to express opinions because it's an opinion magazine and makes no pretense to objectivity. So in the early 80s, mid-80s, I was being invited as a guest on various shows like the McLaughlin Group and Crossfire sometimes, and then I became the summer substitute for Tom Braden, who was, when he went on vacation, who was the previous guy opposite Buchanan. And then Braden wanted to retire, and they needed someone new. They asked me if I wanted to do it, and it was certainly nothing I'd ever thought about very hard, but I thought, what the heck? And so I did it.
You wrote a piece that was printed in The New Yorker in October of 1992 called Mamas, Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Pundits. It's a really funny piece, and I'd like you to read an excerpt of it for us.
Sure, I'll be happy to. Just keep in mind that this was tongue-in-cheek. This was from The New Yorker in 1992, during the election that year. You probably think it's easy to be a pundit. From afar, it must look like a pretty soft life, making a living just spouting opinions. Sitting in front of the TV, watching the members of the McLaughlin Group as they rate on a scale of 1 to 10 the likelihood of a thunderstorm in Milwaukee next week, you're tempted to think, any idiot could do that. But it takes a special kind of idiot. Not to brag, but I know these people. Favoring friends and family with beautifully wrought opinions about Ross Perot or the North American Free Trade Agreement in the comfort of your own home, you're like the competent amateur cook who thinks it would be neat to run a restaurant. But the professional pundit's life is hell. It's opine, 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 day in and day out until you never want to have another opinion again. What used to be one of life's great pleasures, perusing the newspapers over morning coffee, becomes a nightmare. At the crack of dawn, even as the professional restaurateur is out selecting fresh vegetables and fish so his customers can later enjoy a leisurely meal, the professional pundit is feverishly assembling the day's haul of fresh opinions. Here's this morning's Times. Senate passes bill to charge makers for drug approval. Oh no, what do I think of that? CIA chief orders investigation of statements in Iraq bank case. That headline contains at least three words, CIA, investigation, and bank, that together carry the powerful subliminal message, do not read this article. Life is too short. But for the pundit, there is no escape. New use is found for abortion pill. Maoist chief of Peru is sentenced to life. That sounds like a good thing, but is there a catch? We're still on the Times front page, and we haven't even gotten to the 18 stories dissecting the presidential debates. TV punditry adds a whole extra layer of terror, mainly of being exposed as an ignoramus. It's 10 seconds to showtime, and you suddenly realize you have no idea where Somalia is. You're on the air, opinions are flying like shrapnel, and you're about to demand that Nicholas Brady be fired as Secretary of the Treasury when a small voice in your head whispers, "Are you absolutely sure he's not the Secretary of Commerce?" The words freeze in your throat. You gurgle. You decide to play it safe and demand that Richard Darman be fired as head of the Office of Management and Budget. Wait! Or is it the Council of Economic Advisors? Too late.
I love that. Very funny.
Thank you.
Did you ever do anything like that on the air? Actually, you know, get a person's name wrong or confuse their office with somebody else's?
Oh, yeah. I often would blank out on someone's name. You probably do it, too, or maybe you don't, Terry, but they give you a little card to remind you who these people are. And when you have to thank them at the end, it's always a test. Do you have to look down at the card, or can you remember who this congressman is and that congresswoman?
Do you hide the card so that nobody sees?
Well, they used to make us put everything on blue cards for some reason. I think they're supposed to show up less on TV or something like that.
Now, are you relieved that you're not on TV every day having to have opinions about everything?
Yeah, I am. I mean, I miss the people back at CNN, but I don't miss doing the show at all. I enjoyed it for the 6 years I did it, but I'd really had about enough.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I probably am. But I felt at the beginning of our interview when I was asking you about your take on the primaries, a certain resistance as if you were saying, do I have to have an opinion on everything?
Well, I think you aren't wrong. It is one of the luxuries, as I suggest in this piece, which you had me read a bit from, that it's more work than it seems generating opinions on all this stuff. And you want them to be intelligent. You hope they can be correct most of the time when they're predictive. But it's a great luxury not to have to do it. And you really do read the paper with much more pleasure when you realize you don't have to reach a conclusion about everything. And certain articles, if they don't interest you, you don't even have to read them.
Michael Kinsley is my guest, and he has a new collection of pieces called Big Babies. And he's a former editor of The New Republic, former TRB columnist there. He writes a lot for Time magazine, written for The New Yorker, and is starting a new online news magazine. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Kinsley, and he has a new collection of pieces called Big Babies. Now, you're changing your line of business a little bit. You're editing a new online news magazine that will be published online by Microsoft. This is a real departure for you. I mean, you've always been in the news magazine business, but it's been in print that you've... I mean, it's been... paper that you've written for. What leads you in this online direction now? What do you think you can do there that you couldn't do in paper publishing?
Well, being a magazine editor is what I really love to do. And this, as I was saying before, this Crossfire thing which came along was a bit of a detour for me, and I enjoyed it, but I really wanted to get back into magazine editing. And one advantage of an online magazine is that people will back me to do it, because it's new and because people are searching for ways to fulfill the promise of the technology. But the technology has three different sorts of advantages over print. It has many disadvantages compared to print. It's new. People don't have computers. People don't like to read things on computers. All these are challenges we face, but it does have several advantages. Number one, there's a huge economic advantage in that you don't have to print. You don't have to pay postage, you don't have to pay for paper, which is very expensive, you don't have to tear down trees for that matter for it. And we're going to pass that economic advantage on to our readers. This will be a lot cheaper than a Time or a Newsweek or a New Yorker or the New Republic or one of those magazines. Number two, delivery is instantaneous. You know, living out here in Washington State, I realize I was sort of spoiled in Washington, D.C. I got all my media very quickly. You know, I even got hand-delivered copies of Time and Newsweek and The New Yorker hot off the presses, only a day or two old, whereas as a regular subscriber out in the West, I get it 5 or 6 days down the road. Well, in an online magazine, you don't have to be a VIP to get it instantaneously. And the other advantage of online magazines is the one that gets most of the attention, but in a way interests me least, which is the multimedia, the interactivity. You can have back and forth with your readers. You can have the reader can click around and do different things, and you can have movie reviews with clips of the movie in it and that sort of thing. And well, we're going to have quite a bit of that, but I think a lot of that can be quite gimmicky, too.
Yes, I was wondering if you felt you were getting pushed into a gimmicky direction, because there's so much pressure now, and everybody's doing stuff online to be unique to what can be done online and can't possibly be done in print.
We're trying to have a rule at this publication that we are only going to do these technological whiz-bang things, if they really have journalistic value, if they really enhance the journalism, and we're not going to do them for their own sake. Now, I will say this, being out at Microsoft and being surrounded by technological geniuses and seeing all the stuff they can do, it's very hard to resist the temptation to say, well, let's do this, let's do that, because it is sort of cool, as they like to say. And so I'm sure I've weakened my principles to some extent in the past couple of months as I've been getting into this, but we're going to try and hold fast to the rule that it's the journalism, stupid, to paraphrase James Carville.
Well, we'll hold you accountable.
Thanks.
Now, are you going to try to make money through advertising?
Making money is an aspiration. We hope to at least break even and possibly make money. through advertising. We're also, it's not going to be free, though, to subscribers. It will cost something, but it will cost a lot less than a traditional magazine.
So it will be subscriber. You know, I'm thinking that a lot of publications are maybe rethinking how and where advertising is placed in online publications as opposed to paper publications.
Well, that's one of 20 or 30 dozen fascinating questions that I spend my day thinking about instead of thinking about who's going to win the next primary. One of the reasons I enjoy doing that. This is a brand new field, and where you put the advertising, what the relationship with the advertiser is. One of the things that bothers me about a lot of stuff online is that the firewall between the advertising and the editorial content is a lot fuzzier than it is in traditional print journalism.
Well, why is it fuzzier online?
I think it's partly because people are just still floundering to create the rules, and partly because a lot of journalists are not involved in it yet. It tends to be more the business side of things. And a lot of the websites are actually run by the sponsors. It's sort of like the early days of television when you had Texaco Star Theater, and it was the companies that were the sponsors that were essentially producing the TV shows. And there's a lot of that sort of thing online, although many of the sites are not like that.
Your online publication isn't being published just yet. What's your start date?
Our start date is we're looking at toward the end of May.
Do you wish that you were publishing now during the big primary race, or are you just as glad to not have to cover the day-by-day politics of it?
It doesn't bother me to miss that for precisely the reason you say. This publication, first of all, it's not going to be partisan. It's not going to be a liberal publication. It's not going to be a conservative publication for that matter. It's going to be whatever it turns out to be. We're going to try and have sharp writers and sharp analysts commenting and analyzing events. But it's also going to be more about policy than politics. And if we were up a month ago, we would have been talking about whether the flat tax is a good idea or not, much more than whether it benefits one candidate over the other.
Okay, well, Michael Kinsley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Kinsley's new collection of essays is called Big Babies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Stephen McCauley has a new comic novel about fathers and sons and underachieving in midlife. Coming up, we'll talk with McCauley about his new novel, The Man of the House. And are experts too quick to predict the downfall of Apple Computer? Commentator Stephen Levy wonders.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Stephen McCauley. His observational humor hooked readers of his first two novels, The Object of My Affection and The Easy Way Out. Reviewing his new novel, The Man of the House, in The Washington Post, Kevin Allman wrote, "Stephen McCauley puts the fun into dysfunction. His specialty is creating characters who are stuck in dead-end relationships, stuck in dead-end jobs, stuck trying to meet their family's expectations and their own, all the while making their messy lives seem very, very funny." The Man of the House is about a gay man in his mid-30s named Clyde, who teaches literature in an adult education program he doesn't much respect. He hopes each day for a letter or something that will transform his life into the perfect life. Clyde lives in an apartment building in Cambridge with a roommate who's very attractive and straight. Here's a reading from the beginning of the book in which Clyde describes himself.
"I had almost complete privacy. I'd moved in with Marcus 2 years earlier, after the breakup of a relationship, desperately longing for and dreading privacy. There's a fine line between the gorgeous luxury of not having to account for your time and the loneliness of knowing that no one cares what the hell you do with it. And some days, most days, I suppose, I wasn't sure which side of it I was on. As I walked past the bureau I had wedged into one corner under the eaves, I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror and stopped short. The problem with having a housemate as handsome as Marcus was that I sometimes took his face as standard issue. Then I'd walk past a mirror and have to suffer through the comparison. It wasn't that I had any desire to carry around the burden of Marcus's languid blonde beauty. It was just that lately, the few things I'd once considered assets in my appearance were beginning to work against me. The lean and hungry, unkempt and addled look I'd cultivated throughout my 20s was beginning to read like desperation and indigence as I stepped into my mid-30s. At a certain age, the unkempt and hungry look is attractive only if you're neither, and the truth is, I was at least a little of both. Even my eyeglasses were turning against me. Almost daily, the black, clunky things I'd been wearing for years appeared less and less East Village and more Steve Allen. I'd chosen them years earlier as a fashion statement, but I'd made a mistake, and now it looked as if they'd chosen me. The depressing part was I was stuck with what I'd made myself into, and I couldn't pretend that it was only a matter of minutes before I turned everything around and started getting expensive haircuts and flattering eyeglasses. Some things have to be hammered out in youth. Past the age of 33, no one ever becomes stylish, any more than he takes up smoking or develops a passion for John Steinbeck. Besides, considering the astonishing number of people I knew who'd been plowed under before making it out of their 20s, aging felt like a privilege, the kind of privilege you should complain about only in private."
That's Stephen McCauley reading from the first chapter of his new book, Man of the House. Well, Stephen, how do you think you physically compare to the character you just described?
In reality or my self-image?
Well, both. Oh, let's do both.
I hope I'm not quite as bedraggled as that character. And I don't wear glasses, so that's one major distinction. But I suppose I sometimes feel that way, you know, like a little bit over the line in certain ways, you know, like I should have changed styles a while ago, or I wish I had done this in my youth. And
no, I have to describe the picture on the back of your book. You're wearing a striped shirt, a tie, and a vest. And you're posed lying down on your stomach with your head supported on your bent arm. And, looking pretty attractive. And there's something about the language of that pose that looks to me like it's meant to read, you know, hunk. You know, like, do you know what I mean? Like that this is a pose that's
the magic of photography.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering how you feel about that pose. Because the self-image of the character in the book is so, he's so insecure about his looks and everything, and there's so much security in a pose like that.
Well, I mean, it's relatively easy to feel secure about the way you look for the split second that it takes to snap a photograph. And so for that split second, I guess, you know, I felt secure because the photographer was saying, oh, you look great, and, you know, that's great, that's terrific. But most days I walk around feeling much more like my character, Clyde.
Now, in your book, Man of the House, the main character's mother has recently died, and he's now trying to resolve his relationship with his aging father. Now, I understand you wrote this book after your father died. Did you have a strained relationship with him the way your character does?
I did. My father's a very different kind of person from the man in the book, who is a completely unyielding individual who doesn't really have a whole lot going for him. He lives in the basement of the sister's house, and he's unrelentingly critical. And that wasn't the case with my own father. On the other hand, we did have a very strained relationship. And up to the time he died, I thought, well, we're really going to resolve this relationship. We're going to make up all of our differences and have some kind of, I suppose I was thinking, frankly, you know, deathbed reunion kind of situation. But it never happened. And I realized after that time that, in fact, the relationship had been resolved. It had been resolved all along. It just wasn't one that I could accept. It wasn't a resolution that I could accept.
What was the resolution?
Well, truly, the last thing that my father said to me, he had been sick for a long time, and not a long time, had been sick for a couple of months, and I'd been somewhat involved in the caretaking at the end, and one day, as I was leaving his room, he said, "Will you please get a haircut?" And I said, "No, I won't," and that was the last exchange we ever had, and I felt very sad about that for a long time, and then I realized, well, that had kind of been a lot of what our relationship had been about, is, you know, trying to impose his will on me and me resisting and neither one of us yielding very much. And so it seemed almost perfect in a way.
You know, in the novel, when the main character's mother dies, the father calls him up and says, "Get a haircut." And and the son says, why are you telling me this? And he says, well, your mother died and you'll need a haircut for the funeral. But that's right. That's his real clumsy way of breaking the news. I guess that's a play on what actually happened to you, that the last conversation you had with your father was about a haircut.
Yeah. And I imagine this family in the novel, like all families that have a certain degree of dysfunction, to use that word, of having contorted lines of communication, you know, where you say one thing and you mean something else. And the only way the father can really begin to even talk about the mother's death is through this command, you know, get a haircut, and then as if the mother's death is almost parenthetical to that.
Are you comfortable writing about your father in this way? I know you're not literally writing about your father, but the father in this book is patterned, at least in part, on your father. So do you feel guilty that you're not, you know, casting him in a more heroic light? Writers have a hard job.
Well, I'm pretty clear about who the character is and who my father is and what my relationship with my father was and what the relationship in this book is. You know, I really do make a pretty clear distinction. So I don't feel as if I'm writing about my father. I certainly feel as if I'm writing from a lot of the feelings that I had about my relationship with my father. But, you know, once I begin putting a character down on the page, he or she takes on a life of his or her own. And so I don't really feel like I'm writing about my father. I'm certainly not writing a portrait of him any more than I'm writing a portrait of myself.
The mother in your novel, in the last year of her life, dreams up these bizarre recipes that approach science fiction. She saves them in a shoebox, which the main character discovers. How did you come up with this conceit?
Well, I spend a lot of time shopping at thrift shops and church basements and rummage sales, and you always come across these, you know, and basically I'm looking for books all the time, and you always come across these spiral-bound cookbooks that have been put together by the Kiwanis Club or the Ladies Auxiliary of something or other, and they're these really strange recipes that people send in, you know. And my favorite one was one called Coke and Pie Cherry Salad, and it was this really amazing concoction of Coca-Cola and, you know, cans of cherry pie filling and on and on. But in the middle of it, there was, the ingredient was 1/4 teaspoon water. I just thought, what purpose could this possibly serve, this quarter teaspoon of water? And after, you know, having a lot of belly laughs about that, I realized that the book had been printed up many years earlier, and that the person who had written that recipe was probably dead. And, you know, and she came alive to me somehow or other in some strange way. I guess it was the writer in me, you know, that thought, well, and I found something very touching in that someone had sat down and put this crazy recipe together and made this stab at immortality. And that's what I wanted to give the mother, you know, that she was this rather unhappy person writing these completely insane recipes like tuna cookies and no-bake meatloaf. And but it was really a desire to create something for her kids and for the future. And she also annotates them with all these comments about, oh, these are great for the family when they sit down on the weekend, and, you know, all things that never happened in her family.
You're in your life more successful than Clyde, your character, is. He's you're in a long-term relationship. He's not. You've taught writing at Harvard and Wellesley. Your character teaches at The Learning Place. And he describes this as courses that manage to sound both intellectually challenging and embarrassingly trendy, like haute cuisine for the hungry heart and the Peter Pan syndrome in the novels of George Eliot and Gail Godwin. And you're a successful writer, and your character doesn't even have that ambition. So tell me about writing about a character who hasn't achieved what you have.
Well, you know, I have a lot of trouble writing, and I'm very critical of my own work, and I think that's why I write rather slowly, is because every sentence I put down on the page, I immediately think, oh, you know, God, that's so horrible, and how could I have written that? And so I often feel like that character who is as underachieving as he is, and then I have to remind myself, no, well, wait, I have written three novels, and, you know, I have had a successful teaching career and so on. But it's not something that comes natural to me. I mean, I have to remind myself of those things. My deeper instincts are to think, you know, I'm teaching haute cuisine for the hungry heart, and can't really get out of bed in the morning, and, you know.
Well, I read in your bio that you've actually done a lot of odd jobs over the years, and I imagine you've done these because you needed to make a living and weren't making a living from your writing. So you want to run through some of the jobs that you've had over the years?
Well, let's see. Most recently, I worked for about 7 years off and on as a travel agent, which was somewhat disastrous because... I mean, among other things, I really don't like to travel, and my second novel.
Perfect.
Yeah, it was a perfect job. And then it led to a travel column that I used to write, which was also somewhat disastrous because I was always writing about people's horrible vacations and, you know, the bad time they were having, and that column didn't last too long. But, oh, God, what else have I done? I mean, you know, the kinds of jobs that people do when they haven't really settled into anything resembling a career and are just trying to get by. And for me, I think what I was really trying to do is avoid sitting down and writing because it seemed like such an audacious ambition to want to write a novel, you know. So I spent a lot of time selling vitamins and, I mean, you know, the list goes on and on.
My guest is Stephen McCauley. He's the author of the new novel, The Man of the House. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen McCauley. His novels include The Object of My Affection, The Easy Way Out, and a new novel called The Man of the House. In your new novel, the main character's homosexuality is, it's just not an issue. It's just, I mean, he's gay and period. You know, there's no struggling over gay identity and all of that. Did you ever write a novel in which there was that struggle?
No, not really. In all three of my novels, the sexuality is just a given. And, you know, it's not to say that it's incidental in any way, because given the society that we live in and, you know, I mean, just the politics of being gay, it's not possible to have a character who just happens to be gay without there being consequences. And so there are consequences in these characters' lives, but I wanted to pick up their life at the point at which they weren't dealing with whether or not they were gay and what that meant and should they come out to their friends or not, but where they'd worked through all of that. And it was something that was integrated into their personality and was just another thread, you know, in the fabric of their lives, I guess.
Now, let me ask you, when I really just admire the humor in your writing. And I'm wondering if you ever write a sentence and it comes out serious, and then then you kind of rework it. I mean, do you find the humor in things every step of the way?
Yeah, you know, for me the challenge is to make it sound very conversational and make it sound very fluid. But that's not the way
it actually happens.
Yeah, it actually happens. And I suppose it's like doing, you know, comedy, live comedy or something, that the timing is really important. And when you're writing a sentence there, depending on how many words there are in the sentence or the whole tone of it, just changes whether it's funny or not so completely. So it takes a lot of struggle for me. I'm not a good dinner conversationalist where I can come up with these witty things, but because it takes 2 years or more to write a novel, for me to write a novel, I can always go back and change things and make it funny.
Now, I'm wondering if you can think of a specific sentence in the book that you worked on a lot and transformed, and, you know, you're really happy with the way it came out, but it took a lot of work to get it there.
Yeah, I can, but maybe if I say it, it won't sound funny, and I say, well, boy, he should have worked on it longer, right? But there was one sentence where he's describing the downstairs neighbor, and let me see if I can find it.
Good.
Oh, yeah. The downstairs neighbor, the man with the hair clinic, is very uncomfortable in Clyde's presence. And Clyde says, Donald always went through the showy routine in my presence out of what I assumed was a combination of self-consciousness, lack of social skills, and discomfort of being trapped in a confined space with a known homosexual. And I had written that basically just to say that he was uncomfortable with me because I was gay, and that didn't seem funny. It just seemed like a statement of fact. And somehow putting it at the end of that sentence and, you know, a known homosexual, just the number of words so that that last phrase came out as kind of a punchline almost, is one sentence that I, you know, struggled with for a while till it felt like it was the right tone.
Mm-hmm. How hard was it for you to start writing? Like, when did you, how old were you when you decided to really take a serious stab at it?
I think I was about 27. And for a long time, that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, I avoided it. And so when I was about 27, and I've been working at a travel agency for a number of years, and nothing really seemed to be engaging me, I thought, well, what have I got to lose, really? So I got together some stories that I'd written, and I went off to one of these graduate writing programs. And that's really where I began writing my first novel, and it worked out very well for me. I think it worked out well for me because I could tell people I was in graduate school, you know, and I was writing my thesis rather than saying I'm writing a novel, which sounds so grand to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something I really identified with, you write, I'd gone from feeling at a disadvantage because I was younger than those in authority to feeling at a disadvantage because I was older than those in authority.
Yeah.
Tell me about that feeling and when you felt you switched from being younger to being older.
Well, you know, I always felt at a disadvantage in the world because I would look around at, you know, people and say, oh, everyone's so much older and more mature than I am. And then I think it was one point while I was teaching, and I realized that I'd been teaching for a number of years, and I always assumed that I was about the same age as my students. even though, in fact, they were 10 or more years younger than me. But we had a lot of the same points of reference and, you know, cultural interests and so on. And I think it was the last year I was teaching, I kind of looked out at this class one day and I realized that I don't have anything in common with these people anymore. I'm of a completely different generation. And I just wondered where that middle period had gone, you know, when I was the right age to be in some kind of position of authority. And I don't know where it went.
Do you feel any more comfortable being clearly older than you did feel when you were younger?
Yeah, I like feeling a little bit older and feeling like I have less to prove in some strange way.
Well, Stephen McCauley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Stephen McCauley's new novel is called The Man of the House. Coming up, commentator Stephen Levy on the future of Apple computers. This is Fresh Air. Although Apple created the most user-friendly computer, it's no longer seen as a leader in the industry. Technology writer Stephen Levy says that Apple may be at its lowest point, but he cautions against giving up your trusted Mac.
The bloom is off Apple Computer. This year, the company has been on the kind of roller coaster you can only create in a software simulation. Plenty of steep falls and no upgrades. The one-time standard bearer in the PC field lost money in what should have been its most profitable quarter. Tossed out its ineffectual leader after an excruciating period of vacillation, and offered itself for sale like a fire-damaged Persian rug. Meanwhile, 9 out of 10 computer users are tapping keyboards attached to machines that aren't Apple. And for the first time, even loyal customers are wondering whether their next computer should be a Mac. Surely this is the nadir of Apple's fortunes. The mood of Apple's considerable following during this spell was not depression, but outrage. They were furious that the people running the company apparently had given up on the idea that Apple could reclaim its former glory. One Macintosh fanatic described the feelings of his peers as kin to the cries of little Timmy, the master of the TV dog Lassie. Whenever that intrepid collie would get critically injured, the tousle-haired boy would plead with the dog, "Don't die, girl. Lassie, don't die." That chant reflected the views of the Appleoids towards the company that still inspired them. What is it about Apple that makes people so emotional about its fate? And how does a company with such loyal customers find itself in such trouble? The answer to the first question is that Apple had a mythic beginning. Two guys in a garage who started a billion-dollar company, and products that were so magical that they bolstered that myth. The Macintosh was the computer that should have conquered the world. In a way, it did. Almost every keyboard jockey now uses the system that made the Mac famous. Little pictures on a screen, a mouse moving a cursor. Unfortunately for Apple, the overwhelming computer favorite in the 90s is not the Macintosh, but machines that run Windows, that relatively pale imitation of the Mac designed and sold by Microsoft. Apple could have had it all, but instead of licensing its system to other manufacturers, the company kept a tight grip on the Mac system. Since Apple charged a lot for its computers, almost twice what the other guys charged in some cases, the Macintosh became known as a luxury machine. More recently, Apple has been plagued by stodgy leaders. Its CEO, Michael Spindler, actually used to brag that he wasn't a visionary. But vision is what made Apple Computer worth caring about. And it was a lack of vision that led Apple to largely miss the internet boom that could have changed its fortune. Now, Apple has a new leader, Gilbert Amelio, formerly of National Semiconductor. He's known as a turnaround artist, and God knows Apple needs turning around. Fortunately, Apple will provide him with the ingredients to do this. Its products are still demonstrably easier to use and just plain more fun than the competition. Its employees still include many of the best and brightest of Silicon Valley. Some of them have created new technological advances, an envelope-pushing new operating system, a novel way to surf the Internet, that may soon see the light of day and bring new energy to the Mac market. And when it comes to the value of a name, there is nothing in the computer world even vaguely comparable to the charismatic Macintosh. There are over 15 million happy owners, and this loyal customer base alone assures that Apple is not going anywhere. And if you buy a Macintosh tomorrow, you don't have to worry about obsolescence. Even if the unthinkable happens and the company is sold, the buyer will do so with the intent of strengthening the valuable Macintosh brand. The most important thing that Emilio can bring to Apple is renewed confidence to make it on its own. He insists the company is no longer for sale. He assures his employees he can turn things around. He promises his customers that their grandchildren will be buying Apple computers. Hallelujah. The millions of users who have bonded with the Mac know in their hearts that Apple has a chance to be great again. Can it be that the people in charge of Apple have finally come to believe it too? Don't die, Apple. Don't die.
Stephen Levy writes about technology for Newsweek magazine. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Marina Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Harmony Books, publisher of Deepak Chopra's The Way of the Wizard, 20 Ways for Living a Magical Life. This is NPR, National Public Radio.